Hello, cell phone.
Hello, is this John Flansburgh?
This is John Flansburgh. Who's this?
This is Melissa Mosey from KXCI Community Radio.
Hey, Melissa. How are you?
I am well. How are you this morning?
I'm doing good. I'm just puttering around the house. I'm literally sorting cables out from one another right now.
Oh, it sounds exciting.
Yeah, I'm like sort of cleaning up my studio, so it's that good.
It is.
Hold on a second. So I'm going to set myself a timer so I don't yak on longer than a minute per question.
Okay.
I have a tendency to do. Okay, hold on, where's the timer?
Well, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate you taking your time to do this.
Oh, of course. Does this line sound good? I'm actually on a landline, but are you doing like Skype or something?
No, I'm on a cell phone, but I'm running it through a production board from about the 1980s.
Oh, nice.
Yes, and it's feeding into a computer.
Natural compression.
Yes, natural compression. It is community radio, so all of our...
better than that.
Yep.
So what are the hard-hitting questions?
The hard-hitting questions. Well, okay, well, I'll start off with... you started in 1982. They Might Be Giants started in 1982. And so to provide some background for our listeners who may not know or realize that you've been professional musicians for that long, do you mind giving a brief overview of your entire 34-year career?
Well, we started as a local New York band for about 5 years, and we basically were a duo working with a drum machine, and John played the accordion, I played the guitar, and we played pretty much anywhere where we could play. We played a lot of parties that we don't remember for people that we didn't know, and we played in a lot of clubs. And then the East Village scene kind of blew up. It was like the same scene that, like, believe it or not, Sonic Youth and Madonna and all these people. It was quite a time. And Keith Haring and that kind of world. And then we made some low-budget videos that got played on MTV, and that sold a lot of records, and suddenly we were plugged into the college circuit, playing across the United States, and also playing touring a lot in Germany for some reason, and worked that way for a couple of years in 88, 89. And then we got signed to a major label because of all our success kind of nationally. I'm sorry, that's the end of our time. And then we had a hit in the UK in 1990 with a song called Birdhouse in Your Soul that actually went like top 10. So we were one-hit wonders in the UK. And we just sort of carried on for the touring very heavily behind our first album, Flood. And the album went platinum. And then 1992 came and we actually took on a live band, in part because we were playing in much, much bigger places, and it just seemed like a way to kind of radically change up our show. It was really an experiment when we took on live musicians then, but it just, you know, immediately worked, clicked. And we've been working that way ever since. We made a bunch more records for Elektra, and then at the end of that decade, we were set free from the shackles of major labeldom and signed with, well, it wasn't a major label, but we've always had really good distribution. We were made a record with these people who distributed our indie records called Restless, and they promptly went out of business when 9/11 happened because they were in the middle of a huge expansion, and that was like a big setback for them. And we were really touring relentlessly at that point, and couldn't really figure out what to do with ourselves, so we actually started doing a lot of outside work. We started making music for television and did the theme for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, as well as all the orchestral cues on that show. And we started doing all the incidental music and the theme for Malcolm in the Middle, and started doing some stuff with the Disney Channel. And we made a kids' record that did incredibly well in the early aughts, and that kind of turned into a parallel career. We don't do that many kids' shows, but we do a lot of kids' projects, and we ended up doing 3 sort of faux educational DVDs for Disney, and then And if you have a kid who's like under the age of five, you have heard us on the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse singing the hot dog song and the theme to that.
I love that.
Yeah. And then we've just been carrying on doing the rock thing. Then finally, this last year, we embarked on resurrecting our Dial-A-Song project, which is basically a very loose kind of, as much as you can write kind of songwriting thing. But we were posting a song every week with a video all throughout 2015. So we've got 52 brand new songs to play when we come through town. And we're coming through town.
Yeah, you just wrapped up 34 years in 5 minutes. I'm actually pretty impressed with that.
You asked the question.
So. That's great.
Taxi drivers ask me what I do for a living, I'd say we do Beatles songs, like songs like the Beatles, except the lyrics are stranger.
The lyrics are stranger. I like that. Yeah, you did the Daily Show. I heard with Trevor Noah that they've remixed it. Were you participating in that remix, or did somebody else do that?
I believe that was RZA, right, from the Wu-Tang Clan, who did that.
Nice.
I don't really have anything to say about that. You know, it's not. I enjoy, remixes, usually, and I think it's a sort of an art form unto itself. But I'm not sure how strong that one turned out.
Okay.
To be perfectly candid, it seems like a pretty. Like weak tea.
Weak tea. Just like Larry Wilmore. So you've mentioned in previous interviews that Residents and Frank Zappa were some of your big influences. And I remember when I was 11 hearing Flood. That was kind of one of those moments in my life where I went, oh my God, this is the music I like. And through Flood, I ended up discovering the Residents and Frank Zappa and kind of going down that line. Can you talk about how the Residents and Frank Zappa and those kind of outsider musicians shaped your sound?
Well, influence is a funny word because I think most musicians really want, the second they hear it, they really want to clarify it and in some ways you kind of recoil from the idea, not just because, out of ego, but also like out of specificity. A band like, the Residents, I think their biggest influence on us was just their total cultural autonomy. Even though their sound is fascinating, it's also really singular to them. I don't think we weren't really as electronic a band, and I think our songs are much more conservative in a way, just because there's we have verses and choruses and the words rhyme, and they use a lot of the structures of standard songwriting. In a sense, like our songwriting structures are much closer to the Beatles or Simon Garfunkel or the Rolling Stones or whoever, just people who are writing pop songs. The Residents are really extraordinary, experimental electronic music project. But the thing that was very, very important to us about the Residents, for people who don't know who they are, they were an independent art project band out of San Francisco in the 70s. And they were faceless. It was sort of a mystery how many people were even in the band. And they just seemed to kind of be beamed from a satellite. Like there was something, and the fact that they had their own record company seemed very, very cool. They're just an inspiring band for a band like us, because it sort of showed you that you could do something very far of left, very, very far to the left of like regular music and still have a career. I guess that's the biggest challenge is, there weren't that many examples of independent artists back then. In terms of Frank Zappa, I have a very hard time just sort of saying like I like Frank Zappa, because I have a very hard time with his sexual politics. Like I really feel like there's some lyrical content in some of his sort of mid 70s work. The whole groupie thing really turns me off. There's something you know, I am a perfectly uptight person, but and I don't mean to sound like a prude, but I feel like there's something very lost in its time about the groupie mentality.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
And you know, maybe you had to be there, or maybe you wouldn't want to be there. But in 2016, it just seems a little creepy to me.
fair. They Might Be Giants works a lot. Like you just said, you wrapped up the year-long weekly video Dial a Song. And in March and April, you've got 19 shows in 3 weeks with very few days off to wrap up this larger tour. The work must be really fun for you to keep doing it for so long. Is it more fun to tour, or is it more enjoyable to spend your time writing in the studio and doing home recordings?
Well, that's really shifted over the years. We used to really have a hard time physically touring because we would constantly be losing our voices and getting sick, and I think we're just not used to it. Now we're really used to it, and we kind of can hold ourselves together better. I feel like we can actually do, you know, I do a lot more stuff like that to keep my scene together. I actually do vocal warm-ups and all these things that I, you know, as a young man, I just thought was like nonsense. But I feel like I'm a much better live singer than I was when I was younger. I can sing louder and in key, in tune. You know, our lives at home have gotten more complicated. So going on the road is suddenly seems like a vacation. We have a lot more obligations, when we're in New York than we used to. So maybe that's why going on tour seems so simple now.
Oh, that's really interesting.
It's funny that it's morphed. You know, I remember a time thinking like there's nothing more complicated than being on the road, and then my life got infinitely more complicated. So,
yes, family and work
Yeah,
exactly. Well, I remember I used to call the Dial a Song long distance on the phone in like the early aughts, late 90s, and it was all on an answering machine, and then it paused, I believe, in 2008. And
I guess that's when it ended. I mean, it was really on the fritz for years. For people who aren't familiar with what the Dial a Song project, how it started, basically in the early 80s, we had a phone machine in the kitchen of my Brooklyn apartment. And it was really the beginning of phone machines as a trend. It was only people like actors in New York and, you know, photographers and people, sort of itinerant people, had phone machines. It was like a substitute for having a phone answering service. That was really like the original thing. And it was kind of like the cell phone itself. I mean, the cell phone has an idea, which is that once you realize you can have it, like you can have it, all of a sudden, like your parents want one too. You know, it wasn't something that I think initially seemed that universal. Like, what you have a cell phone. If you're not home, you just don't answer the phone. But it really caught on, and so I had this idea of putting a song on the outgoing message, and I got a cassette phone machine that had an unlimited outgoing message, and it just would play a different song every day. And it was a regular, you know, Brooklyn line, so it didn't really cost anything more than having a phone, which I needed to have anyway. Although it was hard to explain to people why they had to listen to a 2-minute-long song before they could leave me a message. And then it had a life of its own. I mean, it was a very nice way to introduce the band to the world, because it was so different than just, you know, somebody saying, like, oh, they've got this, you know, one song that's good, or they're this, like, this hot live act. It was like, oh, they're, I mean, sort of getting back to the Residents thing, like, it was so self-defined and so singular. It was a nice way to get to be introduced to the world through this Dial a Song thing.
And now when you revived it for video, you started bringing in a lot of different videographers. In fact, in Tucson, one of our local videographers, Alex Italics, made two of the music videos. And that really launched a larger career for him. When
he's so talented, though. You know, he actually submitted, originally, he submitted, we met him through a video contest that we ran, and he was one of the winners. So I love his style. He's so, he's got so much visual control, and it's such funny ideas.
Did you want to give artists exposure and platform? Was that part of why you decided to do it as a video?
Well, we've always done a lot of visuals. We've always collaborated with visual artists throughout our entire career. I mean, very early on, we decided we didn't want to have our pictures on our records, so that basically raised the bar as to what kind of creative decision making would go into the album covers. And so we were automatically collaborating with photographers and illustrators and just graphic design people to do record covers that were more, that were bolder. And that was kind of the beginning of it. We collaborated with a fellow named Adam Bernstein on some early videos that were very, very cheaply made, in spite of having some very good ideas. Adam later on, you know, went on to do some very famous rock videos for like the B-52s, and he did the Baby Got Back video. And he also, now he's like directed episodes of Oz, he directed episodes of Fargo, I think he did the pilot for 30 Rock. So he's got a long, you know, he was an extremely ambitious, extremely talented guy. And, and we were just very lucky to kind of catch him on his ascent. And so I guess, you know, speaking as an art school graduate, I just always knew there was a community of people out there who would kind of want that kind of break, you know. You find somebody, you know, somebody who's hungry and just is looking for an opportunity to do something. And for us, it's like a win-win situation, because we don't have a lot of money, but we do have a lot of ideas, and it seems like visual people kind of are drawn to what we do. And the technology has just morphed in the past 15 years, where if you were an animator or a motion graphics person, or even just a filmmaker, you can do a lot more of the production work on a computer, and maybe even just like do it on your laptop. So there are a lot of people who are doing like the homebrew creative work, and that's very exciting for us. We did the kids stuff we did for Disney was all, you know, there were hour long, fully animated DVDs that we were doing, working with like huge teams of creative people.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah, and that was, I mean, I would invite, you know, especially if anybody's listening who has, you know, has kids and is looking to, you know, hunker down with YouTube for a couple of days, there's a lot of They Might Be Giants videos for kids online.
Well, speaking of the visual element, you've always had quirky, fun visual stuff like the puppets and the stick and the confetti cannon and Spin the Dial and the venue songs. In your shows, or my personal favorite, the Glockenspiel song. And,
oh, right.
Yeah, and so you've mentioned that this is an adult tour versus a more of a children's tour. So what does that mean for the performance and the visual elements of the show?
Well, it means we can swear up like a storm. So that's nice for us. It's relaxing for us. You know, to be perfectly honest, to be candid, when people bring their kids to adult shows, it makes us feel really bad, because the show is really, and invariably, like, the show is much too loud for kids. And then there's these physical situations where there's a drunk guy in the audience, or somebody who's off their meds who like starts spinning around and throwing his beer bottle, and then there's a guy who jumps on the stage and jumps into the crowd, and you know, things happen at shows that are fully out of our control. A week does not go by that, you know, there isn't some call, you know, to an ambulance or some call to the police or something. You know, something happens. Things happen. You know, PAs fall over. We can't guarantee the safety of kids at our show. And of course, parents think like all they have to do is be standing there, and then they can guarantee the safety of their kids at the show. But they're wrong. I mean, I've done shows where
you just have people just come running through the crowd.
It's not an environment for kids, you know. Like you wouldn't take your kids to a burlesque show, and it's about the same. You know, it's not. Chances are that you know you could take your kid to a burlesque show and everything would be fine, but you wouldn't do it. And you could probably take a kid to a They Might Be Giants show, but you shouldn't.
You shouldn't. So is there going to be any fun aspect to the visual performance of the show?
There will be no fun at our show.
No fun at all.
No fun. Well, there's some visual surprises, but I don't want to
okay.
spoil them.
Yeah.
But you know, we like to keep the ball rolling. We don't do the exact same. You know, the show is always evolving, and this is there's some different stuff now.
Now, it says on your webpage that this is the last tour of the foreseeable future. Now, bands usually, you know, they break up and they take 4 years off and then they have a reunion show. But it would appear that you have forgotten to break up.
Yes.
And that you're just taking
a... We should have broken up a long time ago so we could cash in on our... This is our reunion tour.
Ah.
I think what is... We might be working the how can we miss you if you won't go away angle a little bit too much. I think people tend to think that we are just permanently on tour. We won't be going on tour again till probably 2018, I guess, is really the, that's, you know.
A good two-year break.
Yeah, well, we're about to, next week we're releasing our third album in 15 months, and
that's a lot of work.
That's a lot of stuff, and then we're touring in support of it for a month, and so that's happening. So it's not like we're, you know, just petering out, but we do need to, if we were going to do another big national tour, like we have been in the last 15 months, I think we would really have to have a whole new project to wheel out.
Okay, so
it's going to take a little while to do that, and we don't really know how long it's going to take. So
now
it's funny. We've gone away for a year or two, you know, many times in our career, but we've never said it. And I guess it just seemed like maybe it was appropriate to say it.
Yeah, why not?
I remember when we first posted, part of it is also just psychological. When we first announced the tour, somebody on Facebook, the very first announcement was like, here are our brand new U.S. dates for March and April 2016. It came out like 2 months ago or something like that. And I think the very first posting, somebody said, oh man, these guys are so killer live. I saw them last year, and it was like the best show I ever saw. Wish I could make it. Gotta do some stuff that week or something. I forget what it was. It's like an incredibly it was such high praise, and then such a general lack of not interest, but just immediacy about. It just seemed obvious that it's like, oh yeah, they come around every year, no big thing, whatever.
So yeah,
and give yourself just, a little, you know, break. I just want to remind people, like, hey, you know, we're not going to be coming around every year. We're actually like this is going to be it for a good long time. So
oh, good. Well, and you're too, you know, you got to give yourself a break, and yeah, and sometimes it make it more special for people and.
I don't even think we're going to take that much of a break. I think we're probably going to, you know, when we get off the tour, we're going to start working on the next. I mean, these albums take way too much time, and they're hard to top yourself after a while.
Yeah, and the band that you're touring with, I see you've still got two of the Dans from the Band of Dans.
Yep.
And then Marty Beller.
Yep. I call them the new guys.
The new guys.
They've been with us for like 15 years.
Right.
We have a really great band. You know, I mean, we made the right move. I guess when you're hiring sidemen, you can either hire musicians who are technically worse than you and you can bully them, or you can hire people who are technically better than you and then you have to kind of suffer the indignity of having them tell you, like, how your song really goes.
Yeah, do they participate in writing their arrangements or their parts of the songs?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, Dan Miller, as a guitar player, I mean, all of them are, like, incredible virtuoso musicians and songwriters in their own. I think, like, for me and John, you know, it's sort of a first among equals thing, you know. I mean, there are times when I feel like saying, like, when you're in the band for 34 years, you can you can say that. But we have a very solid collaborative relationship with our band, and they bring a lot to it. I think, you know, both John and I feel a lot of responsibility about having sort of the architecture of the song in place. So we're kind of constructing a trampoline that they can kind of jump on a little bit. You know, once we started working with them in the studio, especially on incidental music and especially like television music, where sometimes you're kind of getting, you need to just kick a lot of stuff out, work very quickly. We saw how much they could bring to what we were doing in kind of an improvisational way. And that was a great experience. I think if we hadn't had all those weird deadlines to just create background music for TV shows, we might not have ever gotten to the place that we are as a band now. But, you know, these guys can do things a lot of different ways and have, you know, have a lot of aesthetic ideas and a lot of stylistic ideas. And I feel very blessed to be working with with these monster cats.
Awesome. And do you have a favorite song on Glean? Do you have a song that really sticks out to you as one of your faves?
Oh, on Glean. Well, you know, I collaborated with this saxophone player, Stan Harrison, on a song called Let Me Tell You About My Operation. It's a crazy song. I would recommend that to anyone.
Yeah, I played that last week on air, and that is a fun song.
Yeah.
So you haven't been to Tucson since 2012, so Tucson's pretty excited to see you. It's been 4 years. And so is there anything about Tucson that sticks out to you from when you've toured through? Do you get to experience the cities when you tour?
Well, there's that fantastic restaurant across the street from the Rialto Theater.
Yes, The Cup.
I love that place.
It is good.
It is really good. And they're always so nice to us. I guess we get there like before the rush comes in. So I remember, is the Hotel Congress still around?
Yep.
I remember staying at the Hotel Congress and checking into the room and thinking like, oh, this is an interesting quaint place. It's so different. It's so old fashioned. What is it about this place? And I realized there was no television in the room.
No, there aren't.
And I just thought, that's so weird. Like I realized the first thing I do when I get into a hotel room is turn the television on.
Yeah, it's definitely a place where you end up spending most of your time downstairs.
Yeah. And they never put the upper stories back on, right? There was a fire that burned off part of the building, and they just left it that way.
Yeah, that's when John Dillinger got caught there.
Oh, it goes back that far?
Yes, that far.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah.
Wait, you mean while they were catching John Dillinger, that's when the fire
happened? He was in the hotel, and the fire happened, and then John Dillinger left, and one of the firemen recognized him.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a cool story.
That's an amazing story.
Yeah.
I can't believe no one ever told me that.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I know about the top of the building being burned off, but I don't know anything. Didn't know anything about the John Dillinger part.
Yep, that was one of the times that they caught him, and then I think he escaped again, and then they caught him for the last time.
Wow, so yeah. Funny.
Yeah.
So... And the other thing is there used to be a music store run by a fellow who had some kind of association with ZZ Top there. And I believe it might have even been called, had like an anachronistic name, considering it was in Tucson, Arizona, which was it called Chicago Music?
Yes, Chicago Music Store.
And that place was one of the weirdest. Is it still there?
Did they move yet? They're planning on moving out of that building, but that building that just recently is getting renovated. But yeah, they had the whole upstairs with all the abandoned...
It was like a Hoarders episode.
it really was.
I remember like the guys, like you would go to the downstairs part and it would look sort of like a sheet music store. And you kind of go like, oh, this place is okay and whatever. And the guy would be like, well, if you want to check out upstairs, we got 3,000 guitars up there. And I was like, what? And then you sort of saunter upstairs, and it's like, yes, they do have 3,000 good cars, and they're all in a pile.
And half of them are probably broken beyond repair.
Yeah, it was just very, very crazy. I mean, there was... I had really never seen anything like it when I saw it.
Well, downtown Tucson's gone through some revitalization, so I think you'll be quite impressed with how much it's changed in just 4 years.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so...
Well, I mean, that restaurant alone is worth the price of admission as far as I'm concerned.
Okay. Well, that's still there. So you're playing here March 29th. We're very excited to see you. You'll be playing the Rialto Theater. And is there anything else you'd like to say?
Support your community radio station, man. Freedom isn't free.
It's true. Freedom isn't free. Well, we thank you for your support, and thank you so much for giving us your time to do this interview. I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, I really appreciate your time. Thank you again.
Okay, thanks so much, John.
All right. Bye-bye.